The votes are in. School names tied to the Confederacy are on the way out. Good Monday morning. We're live from Studio 5. I'm Melissa Ross, and this is First Coast Connect. Thanks for listening. Just ahead, the latest on the process to change the names of some Duval County public schools. Let us know your thoughts. It's 549-2937. Then later, another thing you can weigh in on, renaming some city neighborhoods. We'll tell you about that. But first, though, here's your COVID update. 2.3 million cumulative cases now in Florida. About 2,000 new cases just from Saturday. The death toll in the state stands at 36,474, with 11 deaths reported yesterday. And the State Department of Health says now more than 10 million people in Florida have received at least one dose of a COVID vaccine. The report shows that nearly 8 million who received shots were considered fully vaccinated because they had received two doses of either a Pfizer or Moderna shot or a one-dose vaccine produced by Johnson & Johnson. So if you're not one of those people, go get your vaccine, please. Do it for all of us. Meanwhile, the votes are in. Students, alumni, and community members of six Duval County public schools have voted to change the names of schools named for Confederate generals and men believed to have committed violence against Native Americans. That said, three school communities want to keep their names. However, the Duval County School Board has the final say in these name changes. Right now, we're going to discuss this with Dr. Kimberly Allen, Chief Executive Officer at 90 Forward. She's on the line. Dr. Allen, good morning.
Good morning, Melissa. Thanks for having me.
And let us know your thoughts about the school name changes in Duval County. We're already getting your calls. Join us. It's 549-2937. Emails to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. Tweets to @MelissaInJax. And our Facebook page is open. Well, they really did an official vote counting on this, Dr. Allen, even using the local supervisor of elections office. And what we've learned is that students, alumni, members of the community want six local schools named after Confederate soldiers to be renamed, including Robert E. Lee High School and Jefferson Davis Middle School. But they want to keep a few school names, too, in particular Jean Ribault Middle and Jean Ribault High School. So I guess I want to begin by asking you, what's your reaction to how these votes played out?
Thank you for asking that, Melissa. Honestly, we at 904, we are supportive of naming and renaming all nine schools. But honestly, I don't envy the school board and the superintendent who have to make that final call, because ultimately they have to listen to the voices of the current students and make these decisions that they feel are in the best interest of current students at those schools.
Yeah. And here are the schools that voted to change their names. Joseph Finnegan Elementary, Stonewall Jackson Elementary, Jefferson Davis Middle School, Kirby Smith Middle School, Jeb Stuart Middle School, and Lee High, as we mentioned. The school communities that voted to keep their names are Jean Ribault Middle, Jean Ribault High, and Andrew Jackson High. So 90 Forward, which is an advocacy group helping us try to achieve a more perfect union on these issues in Jacksonville, which can always be difficult. You believe at 904 that all nine names should have been changed. Is that right?
Yes, absolutely. Because quite frankly, I know that there was some, you know, up in the air around Jean Ribault and his relationship with Native. But honestly, we believe that even as a colonizer, that weathering away of one's culture and replacing it with one that's deemed, you know, more acceptable or palatable or more civilized is still wrong. And so ultimately, that's why we support renaming all nine.
And it was interesting to see at Jackson High, it was a close vote. 359 voted to change the name. 378 voted to keep the name. Andrew Jackson, of course, inspired the name of this city, Jacksonville. Even though he had no ties to this area, he did commit genocide against Native Americans. The Trail of Tears is the historical event most closely associated with him. So when we talk about changing place names, changing school names, it seemed that the the votes for Andrew Jackson, you know, there might have been some reasoning going into that. Well, this is what the town is named after.
Mm-hmm.
So, mm-hmm. you know, these issues get pretty deep-seated, pretty complicated. What about that, Dr. Allen?
Yes. So, you know, even at Jean Ribault and the same at Andrew Jackson, they have really strong, alumni networks at their schools. And there is a lot of pride associated with, you know, being an alumni of those schools and even the students that are currently there to carry on that history. But the question, and I've heard it a number of times in the community, is, you know, if you do change Andrew Jackson to high school, what's next for the city? And I think ultimately these things are, again, at the discretion of the people and the citizens. And so what I appreciate about the DCPS process is them allowing the alumni, the students in the community to have input, because that's ultimately, they are the receivers. They are on the receiving end of any changes that happen.
Right. Now, and this, by the way, let's note this process isn't over. The final decision rests with the Duval County School Board, and you at 90 Forward are urging people to contact the school board. Let them know your thoughts. You can also donate to the Jacksonville Public Education Fund to support school renaming. And you're having a rally about this week, too. Is that right?
That's correct. In partnership with the Southern Poverty Law Center, there is a hybrid, so virtual and in-person rally that is happening on Wednesday at 5 p.m. It is posted on our Facebook, LinkedIn, Twitter, and Instagram pages. And you can go in to register to attend virtually or meet us at the school board building at 5 o'clock on Wednesday.
Let's go to your calls now about changing school names in Duval County. 549-2937. Don on the west side. Hi, Don.
Hey, good morning, Melissa. Thank you for having me.
Sure. And
my question is, with the school name changes, I feel it's appropriate because you have a lot of people who tell people to get over slavery, but yet you keep those same names that were involved with the Civil War and slavery and trying to keep people as slaves up in the air on the schools and stuff like that. And then, but yet you want someone to heal, but you won't give them room to heal when you constantly have it in their face.
Right. Thank you, Don. And that's certainly the argument that's come up again and again, Dr. Allen, particularly at a school like, let's say, Lee High School, which is comprised of a student body now that's majority African-American, to go to a school that's named after a figure who was so closely tied to the horrors of slavery. It's what's underpinned the whole moral argument behind changing these names.
Absolutely right. And we believe in truth and reconciliation. And so he's absolutely right. Those names are constant reminders of a time period that is hurtful to remember, but we have to tell the truth about it so that we can heal together and not repeat those mistakes again.
549-2937. Thomas on the west side. Hi, Thomas.
Good morning. Yeah, I just wanted to say that the 1% margin of victory at Jackson is indeed very marginal. And we're hopeful that, with so many provisional ballots as well, that the school board decides to do the right thing and change that name as well. Because, after all, it was just supposed to be a temperature-taking exercise anyway. And I think that shows anything but a great deal of support for the old name. I also think that part of the thing there is the argument that athletes needed the name to advance their college careers may have been a big factor in that vote.
Mm. Okay, thanks, Thomas. Dr. Allen, could the school board override the non-binding vote for Andrew Jackson High School? The communities have been given ample opportunity to have their say, but these are not binding votes.
That's correct. And now, in fact, the next step is for Dr. Green to make a recommendation to the school board. And then the school board ultimately has the final vote, and that should take place on June the 1st, which is next Tuesday. And so there's still, the work is not done yet, just because, you know, we voted at the schools. That is one data point, endpoint in putting information into the system, but the ultimate decision rests with those seven school board members, and we encourage everyone to write to them, call them, and let them know that you want those names changed.
549-2937, James in San Marco. Hi, James. Good morning.
Hello. I, of course, support the name changes, but I'd just like to point out this is an excellent opportunity to inform your listeners about something they may not be aware of, because there are actually two Jacksons you're talking about. Andrew Jackson was responsible for much of the Trail of Tears in the Seminole Wars, with displacement of the Southern Cherokee and the Seminole, but he was a different figure from Stonewall Jackson, who was responsible for much of what happened in military history and the Confederacy. This is a wonderful opportunity for people to know about that.
Yep, there were two Jacksons. The school that had the very close vote tally was Andrew Jackson. Hi, James. But you're absolutely right. Stonewall Jackson was another figure of the Confederacy, and Stonewall Jackson Elementary, the vote there to change the name was 114 change it, 26 keep it. So a conclusive vote to get rid of the Stonewall Jackson moniker on a local elementary school. 549-2937, Ernest in Green Cove Springs. Hi, Ernest. Good morning to you.
Yes, I was driving, pulled over to put in my 10 cents worth.
Sure.
Any system that enslaves a generation after generation of people with all the atrocities that went on, too much to number, has got to be an evil system, not to be honored in any way. And I'll finish by saying, if history serves me right, it was General Robert E. Lee himself, who a few years after the war, stated, and I'm going to paraphrase pretty close to what he said, the wisest thing for our country to do is not to leave open the scars of war, but learn what other nations have done and relegate into oblivion all reminders of that war. And he said this not only once, but to letters, to various groups, and speaking to civic groups of the time.
That's right, Ernest.
That's my 10 cents worth on it.
Yes, and thank you so much for that. That's Ernest in Green Cove Springs. Here's a tweet from Duke pointing out much the same, saying Robert E. Lee himself opposed the creation of Confederate monuments. He refused to fly the Confederate flag on the college campus he oversaw after the war. And both he and his daughter said it would be treasonous to be buried in a Confederate uniform. And so even the general of the Confederacy, Lee, recognized, Dr. Allen, in the aftermath of the Civil War, that it would be a mistake to create all this Confederate iconography. And it's taken 150 years plus for this nation to really reckon with that iconography and how painful it is for so many African Americans. It's been a long time coming.
Yes, it has, far too long.
And so if you could expand a little bit more on the work of 90 Forward dealing with these issues in the community.
Absolutely. We are continuing to advocate get these names changed. And in the process, we are working with a lot of different partners to continue to raise awareness about the impacts of race and racism on different things such as education, health, housing, economics, job and labor force, the role that race and racism plays in having people of color be underrepresented in areas of prosperity and overrepresented areas of deficit. And so we want to continue to partner, continue to work with folks out in the community, and continue to advocate for these name changes in particular.
Right. And if it turns out, as it looks like it may turn out, that some of the names stay the same, let's talk about that for a minute, because Jean Ribault, as you mentioned a few moments ago, was not seen by most historians as having committed violence against the Native Indigenous population. That said, he was still an early colonizer. So the argument over his legacy is one of this country's history, which is colonization. This is a country founded on the genocide and forcible displacement of Native Americans and slavery. This country's early wealth, continuing right up until the present day, was built with the slave trade. And so, you know, it's really been remarkable to watch this play out over the last few years. For example, now around Thanksgiving time, we have a newly created observance, Indigenous Peoples Day, to to give notice to everyone of the fact that our early history was founded on the genocide of Native Americans. These are all historical facts that, as Americans, we tend not to think very much about. We don't want to dwell too much on those things. And this this name change process has forced a dwelling, an examination of this history, I think, is fair to say.
Yes, absolutely, that's fair to say. But, you know, I think it's forcing us to reckon with these issues in a way that we have not done before. It's easy to say that these things are no longer issues because, oh, look, everybody's doing well, or nobody, you know, the students are prosperous, and, you know, the natives weren't really hurt. The relationship was friendly. But again, if we are to tell ourselves the truth about what happened, I think you have to go to the source. I think you have to seek out relationships with Indigenous and Native people to understand their perspective and how those things look, just like you have to talk with Black people, or you should talk with Black people to get their perspective and how they feel about being named after having buildings and being constantly reminded of a feeling that you don't belong here. And so, we are reckoning with these things in a way that we haven't done quite well, my personal opinion, but we're doing it now. And I think what better time than now to start to have these conversations and not to end them, but to go on and figure out what are the other ways that we can be more inclusive, more accepting, and more celebratory of the various cultures that helped to create the America we know today.
We're speaking with Dr. Kimberly Allen, CEO at 90 Forward, about the votes across this community to change local school names with ties to the Confederacy. 549-2937 to call us up. Here's an email from a listener about the voting process. Let's talk about this, Dr. Allen, because this was done with the help of the local supervisor of elections office. A listener asks, why are some people able to vote and have their vote count up for up to three times? Alumni, employee, and anyone living in the school boundaries. Why no drop boxes or voting by absentee ballot? In some ways, the voting for the change of schools is tougher than that for president. Okay, so let's talk about the voting process that was undertaken here. Can you share a little bit about that?
Yes. So as I understand it, if you were, an alumni who happened to live in the neighborhood and work at Lee High School, you were able to vote multiple times. And I believe if you were a student third grade and above that lived in the surrounding area, you are also able to vote. I believe I'm not sure, honestly, why the decision was made about, not using absentee ballots, et cetera. But I've heard a number of different discussions about how challenging that was. But even though it might have been a challenge, I look at a school like Lee who had, 6,000, almost 7,000, votes still come in. So it's challenging as it may have been, it still produced a lot of people out to vote.
Here's a tweet from a listener. The superintendent and school board have some explaining to do. This process has taken a year. More meetings than they had for the half-cent sales tax referendum. And it's emboldened racists. And all for what? So they can finally make a decision which should have been a no-brainer. What do you think about that? This has been a long process, Dr. Allen, and the school board has taken pains to make sure that everyone with even the hint of a stake in this community school naming discussion got their voice heard.
Yes, I don't think you can ever be too thorough in getting feedback from the community and stakeholders. That's not a quick process, honestly, nor should it be. I think if you want to, again, make changes or considering changes, you want to have the support and the buy-in of the community and the stakeholders. And that is how you make change with the community and not to the community. And so I appreciate a process that is well thought out. Even though, it's not the final decision, there is input. And it's valid to hear both sides, whether or not we agree with what those sides are saying.
And with all of that said, let's circle back once again to what you have planned for this week, Dr. Allen. A rally this Wednesday so that people can make their voice heard yet again on this issue. Tell us again, if you could, everything about the event.
Absolutely. It's in partnership with the Southern Poverty Law Center, and it'll be a hybrid event, meaning it'll be virtual and online. I'm sorry, virtual and in person. At the school board building this Wednesday at 5 p.m. You can check out our Facebook, Twitter, LinkedIn, and Instagram pages for the link to register. And that is, again, in partnership with the Southern Poverty Law Center, Northside Coalition, and other organizations from around the community that support the name changes.
And going beyond this whole issue, 90 Forward does work all through the year. So how can people get involved in 90 Forward?
Absolutely. If you go to 90forward.org and go to our About Us page, there is a way for you to sign up and receive letters from us. We are getting ready to launch our volunteer orientation platform, and we are forming many interesting opportunities around the community to continue to have conversations about race and racism and its impacts on the community, and quite frankly, to the end of helping end racism so that everyone thrives. So if you are interested in doing that work, please go to our 904.org page and sign up to get information from us.
That's the numbers 904 and then WARD, 90 Forward, and she is CEO Dr. Kimberly Allen. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you so much, Melissa, for having me.
And much more still ahead. Later in the hour, we'll tell you how you can have a say in something else, helping to rebrand some downtown neighborhoods. We'll tell you about that, but up next.
You know, 2020 was truly a collision between leadership and trauma.
We've all experienced trauma over the last year, and we bring it into our jobs. Up next, advice on creating a healing culture in your workplace. We'll be right back. Well, we've all suffered some form of collective trauma throughout this time of pandemic, and whether we mean to or not, we do bring that into the office. I spoke this week with consultant Dawn Emmerich about her upcoming webinar on trauma in the workplace and how you can create a culture of healing at work. Hey, Dawn. So good to talk to you. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you, Melissa. Thank you for having me.
So healing in the workplace, as we mark Trauma-Informed Awareness Day, which is an actual day. Now, you're a subject matter expert in this whole sphere. And as we talk about the long-term mental health impacts of the pandemic and the return to work that many of us are undergoing right now, this is such a timely topic. Tell us a little bit about this.
Yeah, thank you so much for allowing me the space to do that. So, you know, trauma-informed work has been around for a long time. The health and human services sector has been doing trauma-informed care for a very long time. And I don't think that the general public or even the traditional organizations, private, you know, nonprofit organizations in our country probably have never even heard of trauma informed until, mm-hmm. you know, now that we have the pandemic. And not just the pandemic, but we also had a tremendous, you know, 2020 was truly a collision between leadership and trauma. So we had the pandemic, we had racial and social injustice concerns, we had the economic despair, and then many families were really struggling during that time with childcare and school, just an overwhelming sense of stress, anxiety, and trauma. And that started hitting the workplace, right? Like, so the pandemic really pulled that collision between trauma-informed, which was usually always left to that health and human services sector, but now it was impacting just about everyone. And so what I have been working on, and I've been working on trauma-informed work again, that's where I came from. I came from the health and human services sector. And, you know, and just being in leadership positions over the last 10 years, really started seeing this this interconnection between the two. And then, as I mentioned, the pandemic just really kind of pulled the Band-Aid off of all of that and exposed just how much anxiety, stress, fear, loss really impacts people at work as well. So we're happy to bring this to the forefront. Mm-hmm. And Melissa, we really want to start a national movement of awareness in this space.
So when people attend this webinar, is this aimed at workers or is it aimed more at management and how they can help their employees who might be suffering?
Yeah, I think it's that and some. So I think our target audience definitely are leaders. It is the workforce in general. But I would also encourage you to think of yourself as coming in as, you know, bringing your entire self, you as a person who happens to be a leader, who happens to be a manager, and who happens to work for an organization. And so I would say that you bring all of that in to this webinar as part of our target audience, because the trauma and the anxiety and stress are really hitting everyone now. And so leaders often are in a position, some, you know, to lead organizations, but they cannot now, this time, this day, in 2021, you can't forget about yourself and how you are actually impacted by the events of 2020 and how it's impacting you as a person as well as a leader. So we certainly don't want to forget that.
So when you talk about how to create a culture of healing in the workplace, how do you do that? What are examples of that?
Yeah, and if I could, I almost feel like I want to give you a little bit of a, you know, go back a little bit in history and just kind of talk about the contrast of where we are in organizations. You know, I'm a alum of University of North Florida's, you know, educational leadership doctoral program, and I learned that's where I got first exposed to organizational theory and leadership theory and adult learning theory. All of that is so applicable right now. And back in the day, you know, there was theory about being the authoritative organization. It was about productivity. It was about the fear-based approach of getting the best out of your workers through this authoritative type of environment and leadership style. And then we had researchers and theorists that were coming out like Piaget and Cotter and Mintzberg, who were really talking about motivation. You know, what is it about cognitive learning theories and motivation to get your workforce to respond to productivity versus that top-down authoritative? And what we're really seeing now is that if we don't shift and get rid of that authoritative top-down because of all of this trauma that we're all experiencing, we're going to have a mass exodus of employees who are going to say, you know what, I have options. And I do not need to work in a culture, a toxic culture of authoritative leadership. And so organizations have an opportunity right now to think about how they're approaching staff as they are coming back. And some organizations are doing hybrid. So it's not even just about the folks that are coming back into the organization. It really is about what their culture is. And some of the things that we can do as an organization is that we can be transparent, right? Like we can provide information to our organization, trust the organization with information that normally you do not share. So maybe you do share grievances or the number of complaints that are occurring in the organization so that staff know that you're taking this serious and that you're taking toxic culture serious and that you want to do something to change it. Engage your organization versus doing a top-down, how about a bottoms-up approach? Give that staff, give those employees, you know, this meaning of feeling engaged and feeling valued and that their voice matters. Also, in time of change, when you're doing a tremendous amount of change management, don't discipline resistance. You know, lean in on employees who are resistant to change and try to better understand why. Perhaps it's not because they're difficult employees. Perhaps there's a lot of loss and fear that's associated with it. And now with all of this trauma that we've been dealing with, you know, we can really unravel that and make our environments a little bit more compassionate and trauma-informed as we go.
All so timely. Check it out. This webinar, you can register for it on Eventbrite as we mark Trauma Informed Awareness Day. Don Emmerich presenting along with the organization Opus Peace. Thank you so much, Don, for being with us.
Thank you, Melissa.
Well, the city of Jacksonville has an interesting proposition for all of us. They're looking at rebranding some neighborhoods. Would you go, say, to SOBA? That could be the new name of the South Bank. Or NOCO? That's one nickname that's been proposed for the North Core. Well, the DIA is working with a consultant to establish rebrands for these neighborhoods. Here are the ones they're looking at. Brooklyn, La Villa, North Core, and South Bank. And the idea is to attract more people to live, work, and play in these neighborhoods as part of the DIA's Business Investment and Development Plan update. You do get a say in all of this. To learn more, we are so pleased to welcome Lori Boyer, CEO of the Downtown Investment Authority. Hi, Lori.
Hi, Melissa. Thanks for having me.
Great to talk to you. So tell us a little bit about this effort. And you have put a survey out to people so that they can give their thoughts. What prompted this?
Well, so as you know, we are charged with marketing downtown, both to residents and to visitors and to prospective businesses. And so to kind of further that effort, part of what we have been looking at is we have had long had a downtown zoning overlay, maybe 20 years, that created downtown districts. And for those of us who've lived here a long time, we know where Brooklyn is. And we know where Cathedral District is, but someone new might not, and they might not know what's different between Cathedral District and Brooklyn, for example. So part of the effort is if you look at a master planned real estate development, like a Nocatee, or there are countless examples, and there are also examples in other urban areas where within the greater downtown there are unique neighborhoods that have their own character and personality. And that really helps residents figure out where they want to live It helps developers figure out where they want to invest. So our idea was to take the existing districts that have already existed and figure out what those personality characteristics are, who are the target markets that we should be marketing to and that those particular areas appeal to, and then try to live into and implement branding that reflects the authentic character of those areas. So your intro absolutely caught what we are doing accurately, and the survey is something the consultant is doing in order to test some proposed names and some proposed graphics that they have come up with. As you know, Brooklyn and La Villa are staying Brooklyn and La Villa, but without mm-hmm. the district. Cathedral has been proposed as Cathedral Hill rather than Cathedral District.
I guess there is a tiny bit of a hill over there.
There is. Yeah. Billy Goat Hill, which is the highest point in downtown. So yeah. it's partly a nod to resiliency. It's also a more neighborhood-friendly term than district, which is kind of regulatory. And the idea was, you know, this is about marketing. Where do you want to say you live? And so how can we kind of include in the naming and include in the graphics? And this would include everything from specimen trees to many different components, maybe different paver styles that are reflective of the character of a district.
Interesting. Okay, so let's talk about two names that have come up that might be used to rebrand these neighborhoods. For the North Core, the main business and cultural hub in Jacksonville, that basically the downtown area and the North Bank Riverwalk, that could be rebranded as NoCo. And then the South Bank could be rebranded as SOBA. How'd you come up with these names, and are these likely to stick? Is this official yet, or is this just something you're considering?
Oh, no. These are actually being tested as a preference. Is it a preference to have? So let's talk about South Bank first, because it's pretty straightforward. SOBA is simply a shortened version of South Bank, and they are testing both South Bank and SOBA to see which is preferred. So that one's fairly direct. NoCo, the current zoning district name is Central Civic Core. And Central Civic Core just isn't very catchy.
No. That does not make me want to go sip a cosmopolitan, to date myself. I hear you, Lori.
So the concept of North Core is that it is central to the North Bank. And it kind of created a juxtaposition to SOBA, if you were using that on the South Bank. It's also, I thought it was interesting that the consultant team viewed this as a yin and yang district, a night and day district, a district that had museums and the Performing Arts Center and was vibrant in the evening, but was also the government and business center in the daytime. So it had these opposite characteristics depending on the time of day. And that's what you see in their colorways. That's what you see kind of in the four-letter NoCo. That was their thinking. Now, I shouldn't have told you that, because the idea with the testing is people are supposed to react to what they see, not the story behind it, because they're not going to know the story behind it when they see it.
So where does this go from here? And how can people be part of this conversation? This is something that's kind of rolling along. It's not over yet.
Correct. So there is a survey available, and I think you have that information where they can participate in the survey and share their thoughts. And depending on the results of that survey and what information we get back, we may be choosing which one of the various options we have proposed in an area, or going back to the drawing board and coming up with something different if those are just resoundingly considered not authentic or not appropriate or not reflective of Jacksonville.
And what would you say to those observing this process that might argue, well, these kind of neighborhood nicknames should arise organically from the streets and not from a top-down process? What's your response to that?
Well, most of them have. And right. But what we don't have is something that really covers, I mean, the Church District and Central Civic Core don't have that characteristic, and we are looking for it. The elbow, I mean, we respect the elbow as an organic name for a portion of the Cathedral District or Cathedral Hill, and we would clearly want to use that in the vicinity. But whether we're talking about banners that are on street poles that define kind of where the district is, or whether we are talking about other art installations, public art installations, I think it's important to define personality and make sure that whatever we're doing is consistent with that personality. The example that I use is the Duval bike rack that is across the street from Calford Chop House, which is a lovely art installation, but I think better suited to the Sports and Entertainment District.
Hmm.
Because that's where we always hear that cheer. And that there are things that we can do that are more reflective of the elbow in that vicinity. So that's really the concept here, is to make each neighborhood distinctive so that you know you're there when you're there.
And going beyond this whole exercise, what are your biggest priorities for downtown now that we're finally emerging from this pandemic and hopefully looking ahead to some better times?
Well, obviously, we are still focused on residential growth, which creates that critical mass downtown. That's a big priority. But coming behind that is now a really important effort to support that with retail and restaurants reopening and new restaurant development to create the sense of vibrancy. We're very focused on riverfront parks and their development. So whether it is the landing design competition that is currently in process, and by the way, that will be a public presentation on June 24th over at the library, so everyone is welcome to attend and see what the design teams present and offer their comments on them. And then, in addition, we are working with Jesse Ball DuPont Fund, who is doing an overall riverfront parks in programming initiative, as well as potential park designs in the Shipyards area.
So, and not, then the district, so not busy at all.
No, not at all.
I'm
it's
sorry.
A good problem to have.
Yes, it is. And it's good to always to have you on the program. Thank you so much for being with us, Lori.
Okay. Thank you, Melissa. Thanks for having me.
She's Lori Boyer, CEO of the Downtown Investment Authority. We have more about how you can vote on that survey on our website if you have an interest in rebranding some of those neighborhoods. Okay, a quick break, and in a moment, honoring Military Appreciation Month and helping military in our community who are food insecure. We'll tell you about the work of Feeding Northeast Florida, that and more in just a few minutes. You're listening to First Coast Connect on 89.9.
CNS Healthcare is offering an agitation associated with Alzheimer's dementia research study. Has Alzheimer's changed your loved one? Have they shown verbal or physical symptoms of agitation? Learn more at 904-281-5757. Move Day, a Suttoth company, is dedicated to providing personalized and dependable local moving services in the Jacksonville area. Move Day's team of professional movers provides quotes and real-time move tracking technology. More info at movedaymover.com.
The Vizcaya Museum and Gardens in Miami was originally the palatial estate of agricultural industrialist James Deering. I'm Ben Brotmarkle, and coming up on Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society, we'll visit Vizcaya. We'll discuss an article from the Florida Historical Quarterly on the Ocoee Massacre of 1920 and Black Pioneers in Apopka. That's Florida Frontiers, Monday evening at 6:30 on WJCT News 89.9.
On the next Fresh Air, Donnie Walton, whose debut novel, The Final Revival of Opal and Nev, is about an unlikely music duo from the early 1970s. Opal is a black feminist from Detroit who is Afro-punk before that term existed. And Nev is a withdrawn, goofy, white British guitarist. Join us.
Today at noon on WJCT News 89.9.
American businesses are looking to hire, but many say they're increasingly unable to fill job openings. Now, more than 20 Republican-led states have decided to cut extended unemployment benefits to encourage a return to work. But in today's low-wage economy, what kind of work are they being encouraged to return to? Getting America back to work, next time on 1A.
Today, starting at 10 on WJCT News 89.9.
Welcome back. Well, here's some good news. Edward Waters College plans to establish the A. Philip Randolph Institute for Law, Race, Social Justice, and Economic Policy. It'll be a place for scholars and students alike to examine and exchange ideas on a host of social issues. Initial funding for this institute comes from a $200,000 grant from the Jacksonville-based Jesse Ball DuPont Fund. And the institute is named, of course, for the Florida-born civil rights activist Randolph, a former Edward Waters student. Edward Waters was founded in 1866. It is Florida's first historically black college with about 1,000 students enrolled. And this summer, they will launch a national search for an executive director, scholar, and residence to lead the institute. They will examine ideas related to race, law and criminal justice, and socioeconomic policy matters through research, lectures, symposia, and scholarship. And they have the goal of increasing confidence and trust between the public and law enforcement, among other things. Now, this institute grant is the fund's latest for EWC. It follows a couple of gifts that happened in 2019 and 2020 that totaled $250,000 for the Honors College. Let's talk a minute about A. Philip Randolph. He attended Edward Waters from ages 14 to 16, then transferred to Bethune-Cookman University in Daytona Beach, where he graduated. He was the principal organizer of the 1963 March on Washington, among other accomplishments. And more people in Jacksonville should know of him. So we'll keep you posted on this. Well, there's a big population of active duty military in our area, but what you may not know is that many local military families suffer from food insecurity. May is Military Appreciation Month. I got more about this effort from Sarah Hall of Feeding Northeast Florida. Hey, Sarah, thanks for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me.
All right. So it is Military Appreciation Month. Food insecurity, hunger, it's a problem for millions, but especially it's something we need to focus on with our local military community. How great is the scope of the problem here in this part of the state?
Well, we're unique in Jacksonville that we have two active military bases. And so we've got veterans as well as active duty military who are in need of food assistance. So research compiled by the Veterans Affairs estimates that anywhere from 8 to 25% of the veteran population is food insecure, which could be up to about 10,000 veterans. And then additionally, the Greater Jacksonville USO estimates that about 7,500 of our active duty military are also food insecure.
Which is, you know, it's just not acceptable that our troops are in this situation. So tell us a little bit about what Feeding Northeast Florida is doing.
Sure. So we have a lot of different programs that help serve the military members in on the First Coast. Because we have those two bases and they're on opposite sides of town, and most people who are in the military aren't living on base currently, so we have programs all throughout the First Coast where people can go to get food assistance. So we work with local food pantries and soup kitchens to make sure that they have enough food so that they can feed the people that they serve regularly, as well as veterans. And then we also have programs with the USO. that serve active duty military members at their facility. So they're already coming to the USO for other things, and so we've helped the USO build out a food pantry that has refrigerators and freezers and shelving, and they do bi-monthly distributions specifically for active duty military members.
That's great. And of course, Memorial Day just around the corner. Now's the time to support the troops. People always say they want to support the troops. They can do it through supporting Feeding Northeast Florida and your community partners.
That's correct. Yeah. So there's lots of ways that you can help the troops and people in general who are in need of food assistance. So we have opportunities for you to volunteer, both at our warehouse packing food as well as at food distribution events, actually handing food out to people in need. You can also advocate on behalf of people who are food insecure and military members by contacting your local government officials or writing letters. And then if you have the money to do it, you can also donate. Every dollar that's donated to the food bank can provide 6 meals to people who are in need. And you can do that through our website at feedingnefl.org.
Thanks, Sarah. She's Sarah Hall, Director of Strategic Initiatives at Feeding Northeast Florida. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
And thanks for listening today, along with all of our guests and callers. Thanks to all of you. And shout out to the great team here. Producer Heather Schatz, Director Josh Torres, Editorial Director Jessica Palumbo, and Digital Editor Bill Bortsfield. Keep those digital missives coming. Meanwhile, to us, emails go to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. And if you missed any part of today's show, catch our podcast up later today on all platforms. You can also listen right through the WJCT app. I'm Melissa Ross. This is First Coast Connect on WJCT News, 89.9 Jacksonville. We'll be right back here again at 9 a.m. tomorrow. Have a great start to your week.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.